and Lauren's taller. Welcome to Super Dakota. For English, please press 1. Please hold the line.
I was recently asked to install an exhibition at a gallery I did not know very well. They provided me with an address and keys to the space, tucked inside a thick white envelope, informing me that the installation would likely take all day. They assured me that they would provide all the necessary tools and requested that I called a specific number when I arrived.
Dear installer, you have been selected to install our upcoming exhibition at the gallery. Please follow these instructions promptly and correctly to ensure that the works are safely and professionally presented in the space by the end of the installation period.
Upon my arrival, I found a stack of paintings and pictures, softly packed in bubble wrap, leaning against the wall to the left of the door. They were secured with branded gallery tape, which I thought was a nice touch. Each piece had a label taped to its front, displaying a small grainy representation of the artwork beneath the plastic. The labels also included the relevant dimensions, material information, and artist details. A large wooden crate sat against the back wall, with several paper rolls stacked on top. A TV monitor and a white plinth stood next to the assortment of tools. I dialed the number they gave me, and expected to connect with a team member. Instead, I was met with an automated message, which, as it turns out, was the installation guide for this exhibition.
Once inside the gallery, please identify and familiarize yourselves with the tools that have been laid out for your work. These tools include.
As I listened to the automated installation instructions, I expected to hear about where each work should be placed and any specific technical requirements. Instead, the flat robotic voice, with an English accent, provided me with detailed and lengthy information about the context of the artists and their artworks. It described the formal and conceptual characteristics of each piece, as if the works were already installed, as if I was already their audience.
You will be installing in this show are as follows. An untitled monochromatic painting by the Italian artist Rudolf.
From experience, I knew to work around and skim the instructions to get my work done as quickly as possible. I found a sheet of paper with the floor plan, and so I let the message run, tuning in intermittently while I began to separate the paintings, identifying their scale and how they were to be hung. As usual, I started with the largest, which I could use to determine the midpoint for the works. The first work was a painting by Rudolf Stingel, an Italian artist I had heard of before. Unwrapping this piece, my first impression was that the canvas was simply painted silver, a large silver rectangle. This was strange, as its placement was alone on one of the primary walls of the space. As I removed the bubble wrap from the work and reached out to carry the painting to its temporary placement on two blocks of foam, I found myself with my face unusually close to the canvas, my outstretched arms barely containing its width. The automated voice happened to begin describing the work at the same moment.
This is Rudolf Stingel's untitled 2010 SDRS-02.
Explaining that the artist had prepared instructions so that others might recreate this painting. Apparently, the instructions had been written in several languages, designed with images and formatted as a booklet, reminiscent of a product instruction manual. I wondered if they had a copy downstairs. Face to face with the work, I was met with a texture that I'd missed in my first impression. A painted effect of rippled and creased cloth, stretched taut, luminous and light. It had the quality of thin plastic, caught by the condensation of a hot and humid day, onto the surface of a metal sheet, attached through surface tension alone. For a moment, I could see my reflection, caught between the folds. The red hue of my face in strained exertion, as I carefully positioned the work. I continued to measure and tape and mark the walls where the work would be placed, glancing periodically at the piece leaning against the wall. I felt watched, unsure if it was the painting itself or the suspicion that I'd seen my own reflection between the surface of the ripples. Whichever it was, its gaze seemed to follow me around the room. When hanging the painting, I held the work from its side, placing it onto the screws I'd prepared, only able to look at my hands. The gallery was empty, yet my activities echoed in the space, mixing with the automated voice. The sound of me bent over, cutting tape on my knees. The static and crackling of bubble wrap falling to the ground. the top step of my ladder clicking into place, all the while accompanied by constant footsteps back and forth between the tools, the work, and the paper floor plan that I left on top of the crate. I quickly had each work roughly placed in the space, unwrapped and propped up on foam blocks. I recognized some familiar names among the artists, but only a few. In the crate was a sculpture from Oliver Larrick, I had handled one of his sculptures before in Berlin, a 3D printed version of the Hermanibus sculpture, an Egyptian god with a dog's head. The work for the show I was installing today was a version of his sleeping boy. Intricately assembled and made of 8 to 9 sections of printed material, the label said it was nylon, resin, acrylic paint and pigments. The other material elements somehow stacked like an action figure. From just below the shoulders up to the top of his crown was a pale bright white, matching the pristine walls of the gallery so that his features and expression almost entirely disappeared into the room. The sleeping boy was surprisingly light. Like the piece I'd handled before, I had no trouble lifting the boy onto 2 dollies and carefully moving the work into the center of the room. Lifting and placing each side onto the ground, the action felt strangely like how you might carry a child from the back seat of a car after a long road trip, careful not to wake them or bringing them safely back to their familiar bed. After I'd placed the sculpture, I began to measure, drill, and hang the remaining framed images and paintings around the room. These included 2 figurative paintings from Adrian Geller, 1 large abstract piece from Nino Caponazzi, a framed still life photograph from Jan Gruver, and a study for a painting by Stephen Shearer. To my surprise, the curation also included a small piece from Gerhard Richter. In theory, I wasn't excited to see the Richter, but much to my shame and contradicting with my skepticism, I do admit my heart rate picked up a little when I spotted the distinctive and familiar name on the image label of the framed painting and photo combo. I'm often confronted when I have to handle works from household name artists, the ones you might learn about in high school. I'd once installed some Andy Warhol Polaroids and felt the same conflict. I wanted to treat each object the same as any artwork, not wanting to attach a more special feeling to the work simply because of who'd made it and how famous they are. Holding the piece in the moment of placing it on the wall, I was reminded that while at school we'd had to choose an artist whose style we could copy. I'd just been on my first trip to London and taken several blurry photographs of people on the street hastily moving to their destinations. I decided to paint on top of these photos, inspired by Richter's style in my childhood bedroom, for the first time using oil paint. I hadn't realized that the smell of the paint would get so intense that for the first night afterwards, I couldn't sleep there. Alone in the space, with the work in my hands, I was zooming into the painting, trying to find some clue or sense of it. As I looked at the mountainside and the light blue-gray of scraped paint, I tried to distinguish his marks from my own. I wondered what made his more significant than mine. I tried smelling the work, hoping to catch some lingering aroma of oil paint. The automated voice abruptly stopped, and I caught myself feeling embarrassed, turning away from the painting. On the opposite wall to the Stingel, I placed the second largest work of the show. The artist's name was Nino Caponazzi, written in English and a script type I couldn't immediately identify. After a quick Google search, I discovered that she is a Georgian artist based in Paris. Her work was a large abstract canvas titled Seabed, with hues of blue, green and yellow layered and textural, somehow both luminous and murky all at once. It made the walls glow, somehow bending the colours directly next to it, spilling from its edges into the space. I was comforted and drawn into the work, somehow being my first friend in the show. In the second room of the space, I was told to install a work by an artist called Lawrence Wiener. A familiar name, but I still needed to figure out what type of work I should look out for. After browsing the stack of wrapped paintings and not finding his name there, I was worried the gallery staff had forgotten to put out his work. Remembering the empty crate, I spotted that the rolls of paper lent against it had between them text sandwiched in a thick waxy paper, black matte vinyl text. This was the work. I installed this wall piece, taping the top from the back, slowly pulling the backing paper away from the letters and exposing them. With a light plastic card, I pressed the text into the wall, watching the letters take on the wall's texture. Standing back once I was completed, the piece read, "Material groups in such a manner that by virtue of use, some material passes as that which it is not in media res." I briefly contemplated what to make of these words. Were they poetry? Was it an evocation? I couldn't fathom what this meant. Along the back wall of the same room, I was to place the TV and plinth, large white and black objects stacked on each other like a tower before the windows at the back of the space. Once connected to a media box with its LED lights taped over and tucked discreetly behind the monitor, an SD card was automated to play a single looped film. After running the cables and cutting the cable ties, I turned on the screen, unsure if the result would have sound. I watched as a grainy title faded and appeared on screen. A Ballet Shoe, 1975, by Jack Goldstein. Not knowing how long the film was, I didn't stay to check the movie, instead returning to the floor plan to see what needed to be installed next. The film continued running. Glancing up from the floor plan, I saw a single ballet slipper, toes pointed with two hands slowly untying the dancer's bow. This image caught in my belly like the hands were pulling against my guts, making me realize the tension I felt alone in the echoing space. The automated voice had long ended, leaving me only with the works on the walls for company. Standing back, I quickly scanned the works I'd already installed. I wanted to make sense of their position and subject. Adrian Geller's figurative paintings caught my eye for the first time, noticing how both images showed a figure turned from the viewer. In the first and largest canvas, a man kneels as if in prayer towards a stream and a bush of bright red fruits, holding in his outstretched hands one of the berries. In the second, a man gazes topless across a body of water as the body of a duck breaks the surface in the near distance. Despite the apparent difference in the color palette and tone, both pieces contained an atmosphere of danger. In the painting of the man kneeling, I suddenly noticed to his right, emerging from the shadows of the foliage, a suited man with his hand ominously placed on the kneeling man's shoulder. Instinctively, I put my hand to the same spot, jumping when my fingers found a loose piece of tape that had settled there in place. It dawned on me that I had not properly looked at the other works I'd installed. One of them which caught my eye was the still life photo from Jan Groover, depicting a range of assembled objects suspended between ethereal layers of cloth. And in just like the Geller painting, I noticed that I'd missed something at first. A pink gun. This object, both ominous and humorous all at once. The label on Stephen Shearer's drawing revealed that it was a study for a painting. Not knowing the artist, I looked at the sketch's ghostly and fine blue lines, trying to imagine what type of painting this could be. How much colour or intensity of brushstroke would have been given to each of the assembled people? I first thought that the figures portrayed were elves instead of an orchestra. The edge of a saxophone peeking behind a boy's face appeared like an elf's elongated ears. Behind the crates, I discovered one of the final pieces that I should install. I was to place this sculpture, titled Nero Vaso. The piece was to be installed on the last plinth. The piece was challenging to install for me, as I'd first thought that it was a wooden vase submerged in epoxy inside an acrylic box, but instead it was filled with water. Carrying it to its position, I felt the water move with my shallow steps. Not wanting to spill any of it, I approached the plinth slowly, reminded that the more I looked down towards the vase, the more the water sloshed. After placing the box, I heard the instructions to put flowers in the vase. Not seeing any in the space, I assumed the gallery team would install them before the opening. The final piece that I should install was a sculpture by an artist named Alex Clark. The only issue was that it wasn't marked on the floor plan. Calling the installation guide once more, I again waited, agitated for the part of the guide that would tell me where to place the works. Somehow Alex's piece was the last to be described, much to my frustration. The voice mentioned nothing about its placement, only that the works had been displayed before in different configurations. My heart raced. Did they intend for me to decide myself? It seems they had deliberately left how the three items of clothing would be presented. They wanted me to decide.
Thank you.